The thing I'm having is I just bought a stupid wireless mouse.
But can I do that with Wi-Fi?
Now my screensaver doesn't work.
And that's the solution I'm looking for.
Yep, that would be it.
Something that they call drive-by download.
Okay, stop there.
Try to boot into something called safe mode. Take my advice and go get this free program that is out of this world.
Eliminate those and see if the problem still persists.
Oh, that's a great idea. Okay, I didn't think about that.
Does your computer bite?
There's nothing that comes in the computer that's of any value.
Has your hard drive gone floppy?
The head whack is the thing that makes you kind of go,
don't! It's time to call the Computer Corner.
We're not your daddy's computer radio show.
Is this thing on?
On News Talk 92.3. KTAR.
And happy Independence Day, one and all, out there listening in Data Doctor's Computer Corner land. We appreciate those of you that are left in town that are joining us this week. I think there's three or four people out there. And if you're out there, we're here for you. We are happy to be here celebrating the independence of the greatest country in the history of man. At least that's the way I feel. We are the Data Doctors. Today, it is the entire Colburn clan here to have some fun with you over the next couple of hours, talking about technology, talking about stuff that we enjoy when it comes to tech, and, of course, answering your calls and questions, 602-277-5827. I'm Ken Colburn. My wife, my tweetheart, Anita, is here, and my son.
What's up?
Taylor is here to help me. They took their Independence Day laying by the pool, or twisting by the pool. Is that what we're going to do later?
I have no idea.
Yeah. Anyway, we're happy to be here with you. We're happy that you're listening, whether you're listening live or through one of the podcasts. And we hope to, over the next couple of hours, provide you with some interesting information, maybe a little entertainment, a little edutainment, as we call it, where we bring to you some things that you might have said, well, I didn't realize that. And since it's Independence Day, we're going to specifically talk about independence from email. Because as I say on the website today, on the radio show site, datadoctors.com/radio, independence from email, because it's broken.
Yeah.
And everyone out there knows what I'm talking about, whether you have really thought in terms of it's broken or you just curse it every day. Email is becoming less and less relevant. So we're going to spend a little bit of time today talking about why it's broken, what has to happen, and what your alternatives are, and how you can minimize your reliance on email so that you don't have to deal with this broken mechanism, this overused, incorrectly used, overrun, overburdened system that is becoming less and less useful as we go along. You got a gripe about email? 602-277-5827. If you've got something new you learned and you'd want to share it with the world, that's the users helping user section. Your input on that's very welcome as well. 602-277-5827. If you happen to be online, you can submit a question via our little show ask a question button there. Again, datadoctors.com/radio, which will take you to today's page with today's links, and on the right-hand side in the feedback section, you'll see a place where you can ask a question. We try very hard to answer all of those questions. Just depends on the volume and the time. We may or may not answer them on the air, but feel free to ask them there, and we'll do our best to get to you one way or the other. And, of course, the podcast, the edited version of the show, will be available through iTunes and our website and what have you as time goes on. But again, 602-277-5827 if you want to join in on this conversation. There's two major reasons why email is broken.
I think I know the first one.
What is it?
I think it's, I think I realized this when I went into my email a couple weeks ago and realized the inbox had 5 new messages and the spam folder had about 3,257
new messages. That's a nice ratio, huh?
Yeah, I definitely felt loved.
Well, those people that are spamming you, I don't think really love you. And that's the problem. There's two core issues. And it's not like I'm some brilliant guy. These are discussions that have been going on for years. We've never really brought it up on the show. There's a trust issue with email, and there's an infrastructure issue with email. They're both a major problem. Email, unlike a lot of other communication methods, there's no way to know who's who, what's what, right? You can kind of create these rules, and you can kind of manage it a little bit, but for the most part, whatever comes into your inbox, you have to look at it, and there's no real obvious acceleration level that's not obvious that, oh, this is somebody from my, you know, men's group or my golf club or whatever it is, right? It all comes in the same. And if you think about the popularity of social media and why social media is taking off, I extend this theory that one of the reasons why social media has become so relevant and so popular is it eliminates some of these trust and infrastructure issues you have with email, right?
To a certain extent, yeah.
Right, so Facebook...
You see pictures, you see information about them.
But you have a much clearer way to add and subtract, block, whatever, right?
Exactly.
Whereas email...
And you can market as spam immediately, and then the entire system pretty much just takes care of it.
Yeah, but you don't even get the engagement from people to begin with.
Right.
Unless you allow them in.
Right. There's a lot more privacy settings.
Whereas with email, if I learn what your email address is, there's nothing you can do about it.
I can
start sending you messages. Same thing with Twitter. Now, we want to communicate with certain types of individuals. If I want to go and interact with those people...
You have to do it.
Well, but I'm going to Twitter, and I know who's there, and I know how to connect with them, and I know who they are, right? So that trust factor with Twitter and with Facebook is substantially higher.
Right.
The infrastructure issue is... This is, I don't know, most people haven't seen this, and we track our own mail servers to see what percentage of the mail coming in is actual, what we call ham, right? That's the good stuff, and then spam is the bad stuff. On our corporate networks, we've been tracking this for years now, it's up to about 96%, so 9.6 or 96 out of 100 messages that come to the datadoctors.com mail server is absolutely for sure, no question, it's spam, 96%. Another 3% is questionable. Could be spam, couldn't be. That's where the filter has to make some decisions. And 1% is known good mail, ham.
That's terrible. That's one message out of 100.
Well, now think about this on a global scale. You got hundreds of millions of people on the internet that all have mailboxes that are all getting messages. The infrastructure to manage the internet, 99% of it is for crap, junk, right? But we have to pay for this. You know, when you pay your ISP every month, a good portion of that bill is for the technology to manage the mail, manage all of the junk that that occurs. That'd be like, you know, those freight trains?
Mm-hmm.
There's 100 cars.
And only one of them has things inside of them, and the rest has garbage.
Exactly. And you don't know which cars have, I mean, they're pulling this big old train, the cost of carrying all of this stuff, most of it's junk.
Right.
Completely unusable, doesn't help with anything, nasty, bad. So, again, that's why these newer ways of communicating. Text messaging, I think, a lot of people have gravitated to because email has become such a burden.
Right.
Text messaging allows me to cut through all that, get right to somebody.
Right.
Not to mention if they're bored out of their mind in a meeting, they can take a text message instead of a phone call. So we're going to talk about that and some of the other alternatives, some of the other things that go on, like people, I still... chuckle when I see people trying to ram these big pictures through email, you know, trying to send somebody a picture. So we're going to give you alternatives to all of these things, these common mistakes that especially newer users make, and give you alternative ways to communicate with people out on the internet. It is the Computer Corner, the Data Doctor family, the Colburn family, Data Doctor family here on Independence Day for you. 602-277-5827. Back right after this. Welcome back to the Computer Corner. It is the Independence Day edition of the Computer Corner. We're focusing on the independence from email. Basically, it's broken. It has been broken. It's getting worser and worser and worser. Taylor, you think your English teachers might be happy with my helping you with your English?
I think they might laugh and then scoff a little bit.
And email me and say, you're a horrible parent.
No, they'll Facebook you. They all have Facebook.
Oh, that's true. No more emails. By the way, if you have flawed videos, if you have been looking for a way to improve those videos after you shoot them, whether they're on your camera phone or what have you, item one of this week's newsletter, the tip of the week, is a link to a new piece of software that's out there that's specifically designed to create a one-click cleanup of videos, whether it's your camera phone, regular videos, what have you. There's a free trial and what have you, and it's up there for your digestion and viewing pleasure, should that be something you're interested in, or if you're doing anything with videos, or if you want to try to clear up those YouTube videos from Iran. and you can do anything you want there. So, all right, let's go to the phones here. 602-277-5827. If you have a question like Jerry, Jerry, you're having a problem that is very common with what you've chosen to use.
Yeah, from what you're saying, that's not a good thing.
You have a wireless printer, is that correct?
Yes.
And you have a problem. These two things are conjoined twins in the technology world. If you get a wireless printer, you are going to have problems.
Okay.
And unfortunately, these wireless printers work great until they don't.
So I'm better off just to wire it at this point and be done?
Well, it depends what you're going to be using it for, really.
Well, wired is always better than wireless.
Okay.
Okay, always. Because you've eliminated that point of failure that doesn't exist when you go wired.
Okay.
Let's talk about, though, what you have. You had it working for a while, right?
Yes, it was working on one of my computers anyway.
Now, is this a printer that has a wireless adapter built into it, or are you using a wireless print server?
No, it's got a wireless adapter built in.
Okay.
And it was working fine from one of my computers.
Yes.
We decided there wasn't enough room on that desk, so moved it to another desk by another computer.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as we moved it, now it will not work on either of them. And what it comes up with for the IP address is a 169 IP address.
Yeah, so what it sounds like has happened is, for whatever reason, the configuration, I think it's just happenstance that the configuration changed somehow.
Okay.
When you moved it, or you shut it down, reset it, what have you. So you might want, I mean, you can try going through the, like if it was brand new, you just got it out of the box, go through the whole setup procedure again from start to finish. But if does this have also a network connector in it on the printer?
As far.
Is there a RJ45, like an oversized telephone plug on the printer itself? In other words, that would allow you to plug directly into the network?
I don't believe so.
Because if it
I'll
did,
have to look.
If it's a true network printer, then you could just plug it directly into your router.
Okay.
And eliminate the issue of, well, it kind of sees it kind of doesn't. All right, how many other wireless devices do you have on this network?
At this point, just two computers.
And they both connect through the wireless network?
Yes.
Okay. So here's the complexity of, you know, under normal circumstances, when you have a computer and a printer and you plug it directly in, it's the computer, the cable, and the printer. Those are your three points of failure. When you take that computer and say, okay, I'm going to leave the printer plugged in hardwired, but now I'm going to make my laptop wireless, so you've had another point of failure, right, where
okay.
It has to communicate with a wireless adapter. And then when you take and disconnect the hardwired printer and make it wireless, you've now introduced all these additional places where stuff can fall apart.
Okay.
So, again, if you can get it to a wired configuration, you'll never have to deal with this wireless disconnect issue ever again.
Okay.
If you can't, then you're going to have to go through and you know, the best thing to do is try to figure out why something changed. And if it is configuration, then you got to figure out why it got reset, just so you don't, you know, trip over this again.
Okay.
So.
I have tried talking to the manufacturer of the printer, and I've tried talking to my internet provider.
Yeah, no, it'll have nothing to do with your internet provider. This is going to be...
that's, of course, what the printer manufacturer said to them.
Of course.
So,
that is what they call in the technology business the finger-pointing game.
Yeah, there was three fingers pointing around, and it was just going around in a circle, so I decided it wasn't worth even trying to talk to them anymore.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Now, there's a possibility that something happened to the networking or the wireless networking component. Static. I'm assuming you didn't drop it.
No.
No kinetic activity.
No.
It's possible, like static electricity, though. You know,
okay.
It just when you happen to touch it, it took the network card out. I mean, anything's possible. So you're going to have to kind of go through and check to see if there's any built-in diagnostics.
Okay.
You know, a lot of times you can press buttons on printers, and they'll go through and check some things out.
Okay.
The big thing you got to do is get it back up on the radar where the network can see it again. But again, even if you do, there's a good chance that somewhere down the road it's going to happen again. And it's just, if you can get it wired,
that's the best way to go.
Proclaim your independence from wireless printing.
I'll
tell you what, Jerry.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to put you on hold because we're coming up on a break, but I'll take you off the air and we'll continue this conversation. Plenty of lines open, 602-277-5827 for the other three people that are left in town here. We're here for you. It is the Computer Corner. The Data Doctors are here. The Colburns are here. And we're going to talk some more about how you can use alternative methods of communication to eliminate the stress and pain of email, because email's broken. If you don't believe me, go check out the links at datadoctors.com/radio. And while you're there, if you got a question or input, give us a holler. Got lots more to go. Stay tuned. Have you ever wondered what the heck all those codes are when you get the blue screen of death? No, of course I'm not talking to you Apple people. Those of you running Windows, invariably you've seen that blue screen of death. It comes up, it gives you a bunch of stuff on the screen, and you're going, what am I supposed to do with this?
I generally call you.
Yeah, exactly. You got it made, girl. Well, if you're one of those that inquiring minds just got to know, the headwhack of the week in this week's newsletter may be just for you. It's a link to the stop error codes, how they work, and what they mean. So if you really want to dig into that next blue screen of death, I think we have a bookmark alert here. This is one of those that you don't need it right this second, but when you need it, you want to be able to get to it quickly. So check that out. If you are not a subscriber to the newsletter that I keep referring to, shame on you. But all is not lost. If you go to datadoctors.com/help, which is our free help center, you will see on the right-hand side a place where you can click on the newsletter archives, including yesterday's dispatch that was in the inbox of all the subscribers. And so you can just link right to that or click on that and click on the link and bookmark it. Get her done. It's good stuff, I think. We spend a lot of time trying to put together good quality information there. So Andy's on the phone, and he's got a not really fun problem there, right, Andy?
Oh, it is the worst.
Tell us your pain.
My terabyte secondary hard drive went corrupt on me.
And when you say it went corrupt, it literally disappeared, right?
It was there, and then all of a sudden I started getting these little pop-up windows down in the right-hand corner of the screen that said, these files have been corrupt, and then it happened more and more, and then the hard drive disappeared,
okay. Well, when it first started telling you that things were corrupted, that was probably the first indication you were starting to have some type of mechanical or hardware failure.
Yeah.
So for those listening, learn from Andy's pain when you start getting warning signs. In fact, last year we did a whole thing about signs of an impending computer meltdown. When you see things like this, don't take them lightly, folks. You're going to have stuff that you care about that while you can get it, you should. You should try. Your situation, Eddie, now is that the physical drive in my computer has completely disappeared. Is that correct?
Yeah, but logically it's still there. And I've only had it since October.
Well, hang on. When you say logically, you're saying that meaning technically?
Yeah, technically the files are still there. It's just the computer doesn't see them anymore.
Okay, and how are you determining that?
I've ran some programs, some diagnostic tools that still pick it up but can't recover them.
Okay. There's a real high likelihood that you've got a mechanical issue with the drive. Terabyte drives, there was a big push to create these terabyte drives, so we've seen some interesting things happening with these larger hard drives in our data recovery labs.
Uh-huh.
And so it's just like, I don't know if you remember the 10,000 RPM drives, the high-speed hard drives that IBM had.
Those are a pain.
Well, they were called the Drive Star. We called it the Death Star. These things shook themselves. I mean, they performed beautifully when they performed. They were very high speed. They absolutely top of the tests and what have you. But when they crashed and when they failed, it was ugly.
Well, I have a 7200.11, which is a perpendicular recording.
Yes.
By Seagate. So.
Yeah. No. I'm just referring to that just in reference to you're on that bleeding edge of technology. And so here's what you have to make a decision on. Anything you do from this point forward, including restarting your computer, could further damage that drive, making it that much more difficult or nearly impossible to get that stuff back.
I've been running it for weeks.
Okay. I'm just telling you, from this point on, you're going to have to make some decisions.
Right.
You need to have a proper evaluation done if this data is super critical. Okay? If it's something you really can't do without, you're going to want to have somebody that understands all of the nuances of the situation, at least evaluate your situation. Doesn't mean you have to hire somebody to do the recovery, but there's no way I can give you any guidance without seeing this thing.
I know. I was quoted $150 just to look at it in 2000 to get it fixed.
Well, if it's a mechanical issue, especially on a 1 terabyte drive, what has to happen is, this, you know, we've been in the recovery business for almost 15, 20 years here. we would have to find an exact donor for the failed components on your hard drive. Okay, so one, you're going to eat up another terabyte drive, so you got that cost. It's a very sophisticated process to be, and it's not like I just find another Seagate 1 terabyte. It has to be one from the same production run with the same firmware, and it can't be like one came from Indonesia, one came from Malaysia, right? It's literally like donor, like a blood donor or bone marrow donor. It's very sophisticated to try to match these things up. So hopefully you don't have a mechanical issue.
Now, well, it's still under warranty, luckily, since I got it in October.
Well, the warranty's not the issue because the people that sold you the drive are not going to take any responsibility for the fact that you don't have a backup. They'll replace the drive for you? Oh, wait. You said it is your backup?
Yeah.
Well, backup means that it's a second copy.
It's not a RAID, but it is my secondary drive.
Okay, but it's not a backup, though. Backup means it's a second copy.
Right. It's just another hard drive with more files.
Right, but you didn't have a backup.
Right.
Okay. So, obviously, that's a completely different discussion to avoiding this situation is very easy, but not after the fact, unfortunately. So, hopefully, everybody listening is going to learn from your pain. Our recovery lab has a no data, no charge policy, if you want to go that route.
Here's another problem. Tuesday, I moved out of Arizona after 4 years back to Michigan.
Why is that a problem?
Well, I trust you guys.
Well, no. We can do the recovery and ship you the recovered files.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't matter where you are. We do recoveries for people all over the world. So that's, I mean, in fact, we could even, you know, if you had some critical piece of information you needed, we could FTP it to you. So that's, I mean, if you want to have us look at it, we can. What I'm trying to make sure, for the purposes of the radio show and not for the purposes of furthering my business agenda, I want to make sure people understand what is at stake. If you said, I don't really care about the stuff, it'd just be nice to get it back, then going and finding these $30, $40 programs that claim that they can bring your stuff back, you know, knock yourself out. The problem with most of those programs is they're developed by people that are really trying to get you to become data recovery customers. So they sell you the program thinking, you know, you thinking I might be able to get this, get you on the hook, and then say, well, if that didn't work, then call us and our labs can do it for you. Right? So it's almost like a marketing thing.
Uh-huh.
They certainly don't want to go out of their way to do, you know, top-level recovery, and frankly, they can't. If you have a mechanical issue, no piece of software on the planet is going to get you that data back until the mechanical issue is solved. Electronic, mechanical, whatever it is. If you're having a malfunction, which is what it sounds like, you are slowly degrading. Is it making any kind of noise at all?
None.
Okay.
Whatsoever. And it's still chirping away. It's still going strong.
Well, so you mean it's spinning?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, every time you turn that on, you reboot your machine, you could be taking it one last step. I mean, so...
Oh, I never turn it off. Ever.
Well, the fact that it's sitting there spinning and running, that's still potentially going to give you... that's going to increase the chances that it's going to be more difficult or more expensive to recover. So I would highly recommend shut that thing down, unplug that drive for now until you decide what you're going to do with it.
Okay.
Because then, I mean, literally, you may be taking what little life was left out of the drive. In other words, somebody with the proper recovery procedures and processes might have been able to recover it 2 or 3 weeks ago, but because it's been running nonstop and the, you know, little things have tried or you've tried these things, you could have taken it further down this dark path, so be very, very careful. If it's critical, I always recommend that people take the top-down approach when you lose data. Look at the most sophisticated, most expensive, and go, okay, that's not within parameters. Because if you start from the bottom up with data recovery, you're likely going to screw up any possibility of that stuff ever being recovered professionally because these programs are bulls in a china shop. And if they write anything to, you know, and the other problem is a lot of people don't realize... There are very specific steps you need to take. One of the biggest mistakes people make when they get this software is they, you know, in your case, you can't because the machine wasn't working. But if you are trying to recover data from a drive that's actually functioning, you don't ever want to install the recovery software on that drive, right? Because you're going to overwrite the files you're trying to recover. These are real obvious to people in recovery, but not so obvious to the people that are downloading these cheap programs. So be very, very careful if the data is critical.
Okay.
All right? And then obviously... it doesn't matter whether you move or not, email me, call us at the shop or whatever. Let's talk about making sure you never have to ever consider using Data Doctors for data recovery ever again in your life. Right? Get a good backup strategy, especially with something like a terabyte drive. And there's a plethora of ways to do that now that are very inexpensive, very easy to use, and consistent. So, two pieces of homework for you, Andy.
Thank you.
All right, good luck. And unfortunately, Andy's data has found its independence from Andy. It has proclaimed its independence, and he's trying to wrestle that stuff back in there. So hopefully those of you that are in that situation, that's why I wanted to kind of go through those different scenarios. You cannot take this stuff lightly. We've all lost stuff, right?
Right.
It's aggravating.
It is.
Absolutely aggravating. Easily avoided if you had another copy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's something as simple as writing a document or something.
How about that little gadget you have in your hand right there? The iPod Touch.
What do you mean? Continue.
Did you know if you didn't have any other way to do it, you could use an iPod Touch as a backup?
Yeah.
You can tell the iTunes software that you want to access it as a regular external hard drive. You can copy files over.
Right.
A lot of people have started to figure out, I can do that to take these big files from the office to the house. Or you can, obviously you got your flash drives and what have you, but these new music devices all have very large hard drives.
Yeah, they do. You can actually, there's an expandable one, so you can get for the iPod Touch second generation. There's 32 gigs you can have on it, and then there's another software that doubles that, which is ridiculous. But
and if you're completely clueless and you want to try to keep it inexpensive but still cover all the bases, we launched in December a program called Quality Care with the Data Doctors stores, where you pay a small monthly fee for complete coverage, right? So it's like healthcare for the computer, and it includes unlimited online backup.
Right, and so, that's actually a new big thing, being able to load something onto a network online, or not network, but like a system online where they've already got it organized. I think there's like Orb is one of the systems that uses it.
There's a bunch of services out there.
Yeah, exactly, and it's a good idea, I mean, to a certain extent, because the internet is pretty much everywhere, so you can access your information from any internet connection.
And a bigger thing is it does a better job than just an external hard drive, because if your house burned down, and you had a backup system, but it was in the house with your computer. Bye-bye now.
The internet's a lot more difficult to take down than any physical object you're going to have. Yeah.
But you can't trust the internet, can you? These and questions that are burning in your mind will be answered as we come back. It is the Computer Corner. The Colburn family data doctors are all here to help you. 602-277-5827. Stay tuned for more. Welcome back to the Computer Corner. I was just on the phone with Lloyd, who called in, who's having a problem with a video problem, basically. Folks, don't forget the obvious checks whenever you're having an issue with a display. It's a little tough on a notebook, but on a regular desktop computer, if you're getting erratic behavior on your video, one of the easiest ways to figure out if it's the monitor or the computer is to borrow somebody else's monitor and plug it in temporarily and see if the problem goes away. If it doesn't, then you know it's something to do with the computer. If it does, you know it's something to do with the display. So you don't waste time on the wrong end of the equation. So look for those easy 10,000-foot diagnostic things that tell you. If you listen to Mark Salem, he always talks about, is it spark or is it fuel? Is it gas or spark? You got to figure that out first. With computers, a lot of times you want to figure out, is it hardware or is it software?
Right.
Is it the computer or is it the display? Is it the printer or is it my computer? There's usually variables in there that if you can eliminate half of the variables, you're likely to get to a result much quicker. So,
it makes it a lot easier, a lot less work.
Well, it's just how you diagnose things.
Right.
It's amazing. Everybody that talks to us that has a problem, they've already zoned in on one little thing.
Right.
And when we ask, have you tried these bigger things first? Like, no, I know it's not that. And you know that because why?
Yeah.
Anita.
Yes.
Talk to the people out here. Get up there. Email.
She's a newbie.
Email for Camino. You are the youngest of nine.
Yes.
We are taking care and have been taking care of your parents in our home for many, many years.
Yeah.
Whenever something happens, you obviously want to let brothers and sisters know.
Brother and sisters.
I have brother-in-laws. I let them know, too.
Okay. Well, but first it's the main...
There's a bunch of people that have to be updated and notified on the situation.
Absolutely.
Email a good way to do that?
No.
Why not?
Nobody checks their email. Nobody even opens an email.
And then the issue of maybe a spam filter caught it or whatever, right? It's probably not immediate enough either, right?
No. I text... No. I'm working on Twitter, and actually Facebook is pretty darn quick.
She's pretty much become an addict of
the Facebook queen.
Really. She's been using it for so many things.
I've had so many friends.
So stepping back from this, and so that everybody out there understands the point of this discussion, whenever you have a group communication need, in the past people go, oh, I just send it to everybody, you know, everybody know an email, right?
Doesn't work as well.
Well, I mean, here are the issues.
Well, it's not immediate.
Well, it can be if people are paying attention, just like Facebook wouldn't be immediate necessarily if they're not paying attention.
No one's online, exactly.
But here's the real issue. A, with email anymore, since 96-97% of everything out there is spam or suspected spam, the spam filters are out there constantly looking. And you could accidentally put something in your email that your spam score goes way up, and they never even get it. Okay,
right.
And you won't know it. One issue. Two, it's a group discussion, and somebody has a great idea, and they click on reply instead of reply all.
Right.
Now it's a one-way communication, or a one-to-one communication instead of one-to-many.
That's the same problem that I have when I text. So I might send a text out and get 10 or 12 or 16,
right.
whatever my phone allows at the time.
And getting the individual conversations, the 10 or 15 individual conversions, and juggling those while still maintaining, you know, normal.
How about answering the same question over and over
again? Oh, yeah, that's really obnoxious.
Oh, and while you're in the emergency room trying to talk to the doctor.
So if to, like, solve that, what I've done is it's annoying for text message mostly. It's annoying for them because they don't get an immediate response, but you wait until the majority of the text messages come in because most likely they're going to have the same question, and then you send a mass text, which is possible, but I mean it's still limited. It's still limited to the 10 that you can fit in that.
But the bottom line is the theme of today's show is let's find alternatives to this broken system of email.
Right.
So anytime you have a group collaboration issue, there are a plethora of ways.
Absolutely.
To communicate with large numbers of people in a much better way than email is. Facebook is great because it's only the people that you said I want to be friends with, right? And it's there, and it's a permanent record. It's not like, oh, I lost that email.
Well, right.
It's there.
And for me, it's immediate support. For me, it's immediate support.
Right, and you get, well, how about this? I mean, we took your parents to Kauai recently. We had some major medical issues occur, right? It wasn't like we had to come back and tell all the friends and family blow by blow what happened.
Exactly.
In the old days, we would have spent countless hours having the same conversation on the telephone with people to say, oh, my goodness, what happened? You know, because usually the first thing when you get back from a trip is like, hey, how'd everything go?
Right, exactly.
Now with Facebook, people are going, oh, my goodness, I heard, are your parents okay? And I mean, so you've cut out all of that minutia that goes on for people to get caught up on it, and you don't have to do it one-on-one. You can do it across a large group of people. Forums, news groups, there are a bunch of different collaborative mechanisms for having a discussion that does not include email or does not rely on email as that. So a lot of those things we have posted on our website, datadoctors.com/radio. We're trying to come up with as many real-world examples as we can to try to get you to start jogging your mind and thinking about, you know what, I'm going to stop using email for this. I'm going to start finding some other way to go.
Right. Well, what's great about these things is it's like being in a room with someone instead of just, you know, going and visiting their house. You're in a room where you can just tell the people in the room the same thing.
But you're doing it in little sections of time, not these big, long, drawn-out conversations.
Exactly.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to tell y'all the ways that you should use or what you should use instead of trying to send pictures via email. And there's a whole bunch of different ways to do that. And my lovely wife is very good at one of them. So we're going to talk about that as well. 602-277-5827 is the number. I've got another hour to go. When we come back, we have the Geek Speak of the Week. Going to learn you a little more about the vernacular. Stay tuned.
The thing I'm having is I just bought a stupid wireless mouse.
But can I do that with Wi-Fi?
Now my screensaver doesn't work.
And that's the solution I'm looking for.
Yep, that would be it.
Something that they call drive-by download.
Okay, stop there.
Try to boot into something called safe mode.
Take my advice and go get this free program that is out of this world.
Eliminate those and see if the problem still persists.
Oh, that's a great idea. Okay, I didn't think about that.
Does your computer bite?
There's nothing that comes in the computer that's of any value.
Has your hard drive gone floppy?
The head whack is the thing that makes you kind of go,
don't!
It's time to call the Computer Corner.
We're not your daddy's computer radio show.
Is this thing on?
On News Talk 92.3. KTAR.
And welcome to hour number two of the Computer Corner. The Colburns are in the house. Ken Colburn, Anita Colburn, Taylor Colburn, the data doctors du jour. And we're talking about the gaining your independence from email, because email, frankly, is broken, and y'all know it. It's a horrible way to communicate for 90% of what we use it for these days. In the beginning, email was all just simple little text messages. And now it's this convoluted just mess. And we're going to talk about some alternatives. Get yourself out of that pickle. But before we go on, it's time for the segment that we call the Geek Speak of the Week. It's where we bring some explanations to some of the terms that you commonly see in your world as you navigate technology, making you more smarter and makes the show more gooder, I think.
More gooder
because we're teaching people stuff and some junk.
Mm-hmm.
This week's Geek Speak of the Week is MIME, M-I-M-E, which you probably have seen lots of times in and around email. Usually in an error message, gives you a MIME error, that kind of thing. You're going, what does that mean? MIME stands for Multi-Purpose Internet Mail Extensions. It is the root of all evil, in my opinion, of email. In the beginning, as I said, email was just simple text, nothing else.
Right.
No big fonts, no pictures, no signatures, no nothing. Just text. Just like text messaging is on phones, and then they went to multimedia messaging, right? Where you can do pictures and crazy stuff, and it got more complicated. So MIME was a standard that was created so that those simple text messages could incorporate multimedia, pictures, graphics, big fonts, that kind of stuff, which is, of course, what causes all the complexity. But it is the most common way for or method for transmitting these non-text files via email, even though email was actually designed for text only. So pictures. Let's talk about pictures. You can send a picture in an email message, either embedded in the message or as an attachment, thanks to MIME. Is that a good idea these days, Anita?
No.
I hate doing that.
When you have a...
I hate receiving that.
Yeah, that's even worse, right? When you have a Nikon D90 12.1 megapixel camera and you take one picture, that picture is humongous, isn't it?
Yeah, well, especially for sending it over in an email.
I mean, it's a big file.
It's a big file,
right?
Yeah.
So now you either have to compress the thing or do something and jam it into this little tiny straw and shove it down the old, you know, because the internet's a series of tubes.
Yeah. Tubes with ping pong balls, right?
Exactly.
People don't understand that there's a certain physics to the internet. It's not just like this
get out
limitless thing. I mean,
you mean they use like math and stuff?
I know, right? It's weird.
Those engineers.
I know.
Thank goodness, huh? So, what have you been doing for many years to consolidate, organize, and share your photographs?
Everything is put on our computer, but then uploaded to an offsite on the internet. I use Shutterfly, and then it's completely organized on Shutterfly. Everything's on there. And then from Shutterfly, I share them, and I can either send it out Facebook or email or...
But you can share
it. Or have them go to that site.
So you create a library that's available to only the people you want to share it with.
Yes.
Right? And you decide who you're going to share it with. And, folks, it does two things for you. One, this whole issue of we just got back from, you know, a Hawaiian vacation. Here's 150 photographs.
Right. And you can put all of them up.
Old school, right? Email. I'm going to email them to you five at a time.
Oh, God.
Well, now people don't have to come over and sit through the slideshow. They can just do it when they want. And it is on my Facebook. I mean, I have all my pictures on my Facebook.
And they can click through them really fast when, you know, because they're not sitting there going, oh, I better act like I'm enjoying this.
Right.
No more burning.
Have to torture them.
Exactly.
Right? No more burning CDs that you send out through the mail that get there whenever they get there. And then when they get there, it doesn't work because you forgot and didn't close the session. And, I mean, there's all these pitfalls that go on. The other cool thing that happens is not only is it more efficient to share large libraries, you have automatically created a backup of all those precious photographs. 89% of the data recoveries we do for the last 10 years now, and more, and it's just continually increasing in percentage. 89% of the recovery jobs that we're doing, there are digital images involved, usually large libraries. In other words, there was a time when our data recovery lab only worked with businesses. And rarely would we see a consumer come in for data recovery because there wasn't that much stuff on their computer that they cared about. Certainly not to spend thousands of dollars in some cases to get all that stuff back.
Right.
You know, for me, that's all I care about are the pictures.
Well, and the average recovery of that nature can run in the, you know, $1,100, $1,200 range for a physical failure or what have you. And now with 5 or 6 or 10 years worth of memories, people are, you know, they're in that position where, yeah, it's worth $1,000 because I can't recreate these memories. I can't. This is the only place this exists. And so I have to spend the money. And again, you've heard us say it a million times. If you back the stuff up, you'll never have to use our data recovery service. We have been trying for almost 20 years to put ourselves out of the data recovery business, and it's not working because nobody is listening on the backup. If you get nothing else from today's show, backup, 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 backup. And by using these systems that we're talking about that are alternatives to email, you automatically and inadvertently create a backup system, right? Because
right.
all of those pictures you care about now exist on your hard drive, and they also exist on these sites. Now, granted, the high-quality, high-resolution versions on your hard drive are not necessarily what's getting backed up on these sites. So that's one of the considerations you need to look at when you're choosing which site you're going to go to, right? They don't,
right, because if you're not ordering from them, you're not going to get a high-resolution print.
You can't download
right.
that back,
you can't
right? So you're
that.
Taking, and they so they do some compression to begin with. Some of the sites will shut your account down if you don't buy something at least once a year.
Right.
Read the fine print. In fact, I wrote a column in the advice column, again, datadoctors.com/help. You can see the free advice column or the advice column link, and you can see every column I've ever written for like the last 8 years. And you can go through, there's a photo sharing column, you know, what the differences are and what you want to look for.
And,
so.
And when you do that, you really do want to research it because I've got 15 years worth of pictures that took hours and hours
and moving it
to
is
upload
not an option.
Them to... Right. To that site, yeah, I'm not moving them,
and that's what they count on.
Right,
and you're gonna form a relationship with this company.
So make sure you like them from the beginning,
and make sure you understand all the parts and do your homework, or else you could be really upset with yourself.
I know that a popular service with the younger generation, with the people that I know and that I talk to, is Flickr.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard of it.
Yeah, no. The problem with Flickr is it's limited. It limits your
right. Well,
your
it's
library.
For the basic thing.
Yeah.
Of like
it's more
I
for
know,
social media.
Picture. Right.
Yeah.
It's I took a picture on my phone and then I uploaded it to my Flickr. Come check it out.
Yeah, that's not what I would recommend
yeah, it's not
for. The backup, in fact, if you read my advice column, which obviously you have, we actually talk about the differences in there. So check that out. All right. Before we go to break, though, let's have Roger kind of fill us in. Roger, what's going on in your world?
Okay, if you want to know about this Windows Home Server.
Windows Home Server, yes, it's a very misunderstood product.
Yes, it's one of those products you install and then you just forget about it and it does its own thing every night.
And it's really, for those of you that don't know what this is, it's if you've got three or four computers in your house, it is absolutely something you should highly recommend or highly consider. Roger, I'm going to put you on hold here because we want to have a nice discussion. It's great to have somebody that actually owns one of these products. Other than the techie people, us within the show. I mean, let's talk to somebody that's actually been using it so that you understand what that device does. It's something, again, if you're in a household with three or four computers, when we come back, Roger's discussion may be something you really want to listen closely to because it could be just what you're looking for or just what the doctor ordered. Speaking of doctors, it's the Data Doctors, the Computer Corner, back right after this. Earlier in the show, had somebody call in, didn't get to get them on the air, but they... We're having a problem finding or trying to locate the product key for Microsoft Office. Time to time, you...
The thing I'm having is I just bought a stupid wireless mouse.
But can I do that with Wi-Fi?
Now my screensaver doesn't work.
And that's the solution I'm looking for.
Yep, that would be it.
Something that they call drive-by download.
Okay, stop there.
Try to boot into something called safe mode.
Take my advice and go get this free program that is out of this world.
Eliminate those and see if the problem still persists.
Oh, that's a great idea. Okay, I didn't think about that.
Does your computer bite?
There's nothing that comes in the computer that's of any value.
Has your hard drive gone floppy?
The head whack is the thing that makes you kind of go,
don't! It's time to call the Computer Corner.
We're not your daddy's computer radio show.
Is this thing on?
On News Talk 92.3. KTAR.
And welcome to hour number two of the Computer Corner. The Colburns are in the house. Ken Colburn, Anita Colburn, Taylor Colburn, the data doctors du jour. And we're talking about the gaining your independence from email because email, frankly, is broken and y'all know it. It's a horrible way to communicate for 90% of what we use it for these days. In the beginning, email was all just simple little text messages. And now it's this convoluted just mess, and we're going to talk about some alternatives. Get yourself out of that pickle. But before we go on, it's time for the segment that we call the Geek Speak of the Week. It's where we bring some explanations to some of the terms that you commonly see in your world as you navigate technology, making you more smarter and makes the show more gooder, I think.
More gooder
because we're teaching people stuff and some junk.
Mm-hmm.
This week's Geek Speak of the Week is MIME, M-I-M-E, which you probably have seen lots of times in and around email. Usually in an error message. Gives you a MIME error, that kind of thing. You're going, what does that mean? MIME stands for Multi-Purpose Internet Mail Extensions. It is the root of all evil, in my opinion, of email. In the beginning, as I said, email was just simple text, nothing else.
Right.
No big fonts, no pictures, no signatures, no nothing. Just text. Just like text messaging is on phones, and then they went to multimedia messaging, right? Where you can do pictures and crazy stuff, and it got more complicated. So MIME was a standard that was created so that those simple text messages could incorporate multimedia, pictures, graphics, big fonts, that kind of stuff, which is, of course, what causes all the complexity. But it is the most common way for or method for transmitting these non-text files via email, even though email was actually designed for text only. So pictures. Let's talk about pictures. You can send a picture in an email message, either embedded in the message or as an attachment, thanks to MIME. Is that a good idea these days, Anita?
No.
I hate doing that.
When you have a...
I hate receiving that.
Yeah, that's even worse, right? When you have a Nikon D90 12.1 megapixel camera and you take one picture, that picture is humongous, isn't it?
Yeah, well, especially for sending it over in an email.
It's a big file, right?
Yeah.
So now you either have to compress the thing or do something and jam it into this little tiny straw and shove it down the old, you know, because the internet's a series of tubes.
Yeah, the tubes with ping pong balls, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
People don't understand that there's a certain physics to the internet. It's not just like this
get out
limitless thing. I mean,
they use like math and stuff?
I know, right? It's weird.
Those engineers.
I know.
Thank goodness, huh? So, what have you been doing for many years to consolidate, organize, and share your photographs?
Everything is put on our computer, but then uploaded to an offsite on the internet. I use Shutterfly, and then it's completely organized on Shutterfly. Everything's on there. And then from Shutterfly, I share them, and I can either send it out Facebook or email or...
But you can share it.
Or have them go to that site.
So you create a library that's available to only the people you want to share it with.
Yes.
Right? And you decide who you're going to share it with. And folks, it does two things for you. One, this whole issue of, we just got back from, you know, a Hawaiian vacation. Here's 150 photographs.
Right. And you can put all of them up.
Old school, right? Email. Right. I'm going to email them to you five at a time.
Oh, God.
Right? Well, now people don't have to come over and sit through the slideshow. They can just do it when they want. And it is on my Facebook. I mean, I have all my pictures on my Facebook.
And they can click through them really fast when, you know, because they're not sitting there going, oh, I better act like I'm enjoying this.
Right.
No more burning.
To torture them.
Exactly.
Right? No more burning CDs that you send out through the mail that get there whenever they get there. And then when they get there, it doesn't work because you forgot it and didn't close the session. And, I mean, there's all these pitfalls that go on. The other cool thing that happens is not only is it more efficient to share large libraries, you have automatically created a backup of all those precious photographs. 89% of the data recoveries we do for the last 10 years now, and more, and it's just continually increasing in percentage. 89% of the recovery jobs that we're doing, there are digital images involved, usually large libraries. In other words, there was a time when our data recovery lab only worked with businesses. And rarely would we see a consumer come in for data recovery because there wasn't that much stuff on their computer that they cared about. Certainly not to spend thousands of dollars in some cases to get all that stuff back.
Right.
You know, for me, that's all I care about are the pictures.
Well, and the average recovery of that nature can run in the, you know, $1,100, $1,200 range for a physical failure or what have you. And now with 5 or 6 or 10 years worth of memories, people are, you know, they're in that position where, yeah, it's worth $1,000 because I can't recreate these memories. I can't. This is the only place this exists, and so I have to spend the money. And again, you've heard us say it a million times. If you back the stuff up, you'll never have to use our data recovery service. We have been trying for almost 20 years to put ourselves out of the data recovery business, and it's not working because nobody is listening on the backup. If you get nothing else from today's show, backup. And by using these systems that we're talking about that are alternatives to email, you automatically, inadvertently, create a backup system, right? Because
right.
all of those pictures you care about now exist on your hard drive, and they also exist on these sites. Now, granted, the high-quality, high-resolution versions on your hard drive are not necessarily what's getting backed up on these sites. So that's one of the considerations you need to look at when you're choosing which site you're going to go to, right? They don't,
right, because if you're not ordering from them, you're not going to get a high-resolution print.
You can't download
right.
that back,
you can't
right? So you're
that.
Taking, and they so they do some compression to begin with. Some of the sites will shut your account down if you don't buy something at least once a year.
Right.
Read the fine print. In fact, I wrote a column in the advice column, again, datadoctors.com/help. You can see the free advice column or the advice column link, and you can see every column I've ever written for like the last 8 years, and you can go through. There's a photo sharing column, you know, what the differences are and what you want to look for.
And,
so.
And when you do that, you really do want to research it, because I've got 15 years worth of pictures that took hours and hours
and moving it
to
is
upload
not an
them
option.
To... Right. To that site, yeah, I'm not moving them,
and that's what they count on.
Right,
and you're gonna form a relationship with this company.
So make sure you like them from the beginning,
and make sure you understand all the parts and do your homework, or else you could be really upset with yourself.
I know that a popular service with the younger generation, with the people that I know and that I talk to, is Flickr.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard of it.
Yeah, no. The problem with Flickr is it's limited. It limits your
right. Well,
your
it's
library.
For it's for the basic thing.
Yeah.
Of like
it's more
I
for
know,
social media.
Picture, right.
Yeah.
It's I took a picture on my phone and then I uploaded it to my Flickr. Come check it out.
Yeah, that's not what I would recommend.
Yeah, it's not
for. In fact, if you read my advice column, which obviously you have, we actually talk about the differences in there. So check that out. All right, before we go to break though, let's have Roger kind of fill us in. Roger, what's going on in your world?
Okay, if you want to know about this Windows Home Server.
Windows Home Server, yes, it's a very misunderstood product.
Yes, it's one of those products you install and then you just forget about it and it does its own thing every night.
And it's really, for those of you that don't know what this is, it's if you've got three or four computers in your house, it is absolutely something you should highly recommend or highly consider. Roger, I'm going to put you on hold here because we want to have a nice discussion. It's great to have somebody that actually owns one of these products. Other than the techie people, us within the show. I mean, let's talk to somebody that's actually been using it so that you understand what that device does. It's something, again, if you're in a household with three or four computers, when we come back, Roger's discussion may be something you really want to listen closely to because it could be just what you're looking for or just what the doctor ordered. Speaking of doctors, it's the Data Doctors, the Computer Corner, back right after this. Earlier in the show, had somebody call in, didn't get to get them on the air, but they... we're having a problem finding or trying to locate the key, the product key for Microsoft Office. Time to time, you will run into a situation where you need to reinstall something, and you need this product key and you can't find it. There is a resource out there for those of you in that situation called Magical Jelly Bean Key Finder. Magical Jelly Bean Key Finder. Put that into Google and you'll go right to their website. It's a free download. Goes and searches your registry for all the various keys that are stored in the registry so that you can make a copy of that or make a note of that. Those of you that have lost all of your product keys while your computer is functioning, it's a really good proactive thing to do so that you can document all of this on a separate piece of paper, put it somewhere for down the road when a piece of software is asking for a product key, you'll go, oh, thanks to Ken, I know exactly where to find it. All right, before we went to break, we were talking to Roger about a very interesting product that I think a lot of people should at least examine to see if this makes sense for them. Roger, this is your home system?
Yeah, yes it is, and I just installed it on an old computer, a P4 computer, that was just sitting around.
So you took an old machine and turned it into a Windows Home Server as opposed to buying a pre-made one?
Right.
Okay.
I actually didn't care if it took 15 minutes, a half hour.
Yeah.
40 minutes to back up.
It's just acting like a big external resource for storage capacity. How many computers do you have in your home network?
Well, actually, I just have one.
Just one, okay. And you did it, obviously, you had an extra machine laying around, so you figured, well, let's just make this backup machine. Where it's really handy for you folks out there that have two or three computers and a couple of laptops, and then you have your pictures spread out over all these different machines. You got all your music spread out over all these different machines. There's no consolidation, and then you're not going to buy five different backup systems because that's just how humans behave. They don't do stuff like that.
One other thing I did, I don't need to leave this backup server run 24 hours a day, so I just made the setting to come on at midnight and go off at 2 in the morning.
And then there's a little piece of software on your one machine, or in the cases where I've set it up, multiple machines. All of those machines have a little agent, little piece of software running that constantly checks to see if that home server is there, and then on a scheduled basis pushes up any files, anything that's changed since the last time. It just automatically pushes it up. So you have your own centralized server that the software takes care of all that. So those of you, again, if you have three or more computers, you're probably very likely quite capable of justifying even the expense of buying a pre-made Windows Home Server. HP makes them. There's a bunch of different ways to get this. But if you're one of the 90% of the people listening to this right now that you know for a fact you're wide open right now, you don't have any good backup systems. If you don't have somebody you can rely upon technically that can guide you through this, then call any of the Data Doctor's locations so that they can help you understand what this device does. It's called a Windows Home Server. And if you have three or more computers and you got a lot of music, a lot of files, and they're just spread all over the place, this is probably the most cost-effective. I tell you, when you install one of these things, you just feel like, okay, you get this relief from knowing that it's there and it's constantly checking, and it doesn't have to jump up and tell you, hey, I'm there. You just know it's in the background, you know, protecting all of that stuff and keeping you from ever having to go to Data Doctor's Data Recovery Lab. Roger, you were having some other issues with a hard drive that was a little flaky too, right?
Right. It seems that the hard drive would unmount about once a day, and I'd reboot my computer, and then it comes right back, and everything's there, and the files are there, and I can use it. And then it'd be fine for another day or so.
And so you opened the thing up, and you found there was a loose connector. You tried swapping cables, but it's still kind of loose, right?
Right.
So, yeah, and you were asking, well, should I have this thing returned, or what should I do? And I would strongly recommend you have whoever the manufacturer is or whoever you bought it from. It depends on, you know, if you bought it online or if you bought it from a local retail store. Have them, obviously, make sure you get everything that you care about off that drive, because if they exchange it for you, they're not going to, I mean, they're going to wipe it out. Or more importantly, if there's stuff on there that's personal information, before you take that hard drive back, make sure and remove those files. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, it does. The only thing I have to find out, do they send me a new hard drive first and then I could clone it? Or?
Well, I don't know. Did you buy it through an online retailer?
Oh, right.
Okay, no.
I bought it at a local store. And
if you bought it at a local store, then they might be able to swap it for you right there. But no, you need to make a backup copy of that before, because once you let go of that drive, you have no idea what's going to happen to it. And very few companies are going to give you a second hard drive so that you can make a copy first, and then, I mean, they'll charge you for it. Basically, you'd end up buying a second drive to be able to do that. So if there's whatever's on that drive, you're going to want to get it onto something else.
Yes, it looked like I need to buy a new drive first.
Well, check with your vendor first. Explain the situation and see what alternatives that they have for you.
Okay.
All right?
All righty.
Okay, good luck, man.
Well, thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Bye. And in the case of, I mean, if, you know, in our stores, you buy a drive and you have that problem, you bring it in, we'll even copy the stuff over for you. That way we know for sure it all got over. So, you know, choose your vendors wisely. Ken, please hang tight. I know we've been trying to solve a problem on and off the air, and we want to come to a nice conclusion so we can educate people on the grief that you've gone through. We still got another half an hour to go. If you missed any part of the show, we will have this all podcast and up available on iTunes sometime early next week. But in the meantime, join us online, datadoctors.com/radio, and you can see all of the links that I've gathered for the fact that email is broken and it's time for you to declare your independence from email anywhere and everywhere you can, and all the ways of doing that we're discussing on this show, as well as have those resources. It is the Data Doctors, the Colburns family Data Doctors, right? Ken, Anita,
yeah,
and Taylor Colburn all here to try to educate you a little bit more on your issues with technology. Stay tuned for more. So we've been talking about the alternatives to email, because I am proclaiming on this show and will forever proclaim that email is broken, has been broken for a long, long, long time. And we talked about group collaboration, communicating with a lot of people. You can do that through Facebook. You can do it through forums. You can do it through news groups, wikis, blogs, just a plethora of ways of communicating. Google Documents is another way to interchange information. So let's say you have a group of people that are working on a document, spreadsheet, whatever, Google Docs. It's free. You just upload the document, and it tracks who made what changes. So instead of emailing the document around and going, okay, who's got the most recent document? The very common thing I see in email, the four or five people collaborating, and now two people have two different documents because they both made changes at the same time. Now you got to figure out what the changes were and meld them together. It's all avoided with Google Docs. Again, email, it's broken. Trust me, folks. You know it. Come on.
It's broken.
It's broken,
yeah, it's
right?
Broken.
Everybody knows it's broken.
It's done.
Quit using it for everything and everything that you can think of. Look
well,
at
when
these...
you can use it, when you would want to use it, like an attachment, the doctor's office or this person doesn't email attachments. So then you have to have a fax.
Yeah, it's crazy. So look at these alternatives. Look at the social communities. There's one of the links on our website, datadoctors.com/radio, are 13 good alternatives to email that include the wikis and the blogs and instant messaging and RSS, Skype, forums, bookmarking, the presentation sites like SlideShare, collaboration sites like we talked about, Google Documents, or even the places where you can send those large files, which frankly may not, in a lot of cases, may not make it through the internet system anyway, or the email system anyway, because they're too big for, you know, certain providers will only allow certain size files, and it's different for every mail system that's out there. So keep all that in mind. Ken, you and I have been talking off the air for quite a while, but I think it's time for us to have a conversation on the air so people can learn from kind of the pain that you're going through here.
Okay.
You, to your credit, took the initiative to go out and buy something that you thought was going to be a backup system, right?
Yes.
You bought one of these external hard drives.
Correct.
Okay. And you bought it thinking, what, just plug it in and off we go?
That's what I thought. I bought a Seagate years ago for my desktop, and that's what did. It did automatic backups, and it seemed great. And so when I bought my laptop, I just bought an external hard drive and thought it would work the same. It came with no instructions, and so I figured I had to physically copy my drive over to it.
Any backup system, anybody listening out there that thinks the backup system that's good for them is the one where they physically manually copy files, you know, from time to time? Wrong. Multiple points of failure, including the fact that the human being is now the weakest link in the chain, right? The number of times I've heard people in our lab going, you know, I knew something was wrong. I was going to do this. I just put it off, and now I'm stuck. You have some extra complication, though, because you thought you were copying files over, and you actually ended up filling up your primary C drive, which is what we've been working with off the air, try to solve that problem for you.
Yeah, I went to the computer setting, and I just clicked on copy and then dragged it over to what I thought was the external hard drive, but I was dragging it instead to my own hard drive again.
So you made an exact copy of a bunch of files, and now you got to go find where those are and get those out of there.
So let's talk. Copy the whole hard drive, I think.
Well, yeah, it probably tried, and there's no way that could have made an exact copy of the entire hard drive because it would have run into files that were open and said, you know, Windows would have stopped. But let's talk in terms more of the backup situation. Let's look at the different scenarios in which you would want to use the restore. This is the part of the backup process that most people don't bother really thinking through, and it's the most important part. Let's take the massive failure of your C drive, okay? There's two different ways you can be backing up, generally speaking. One is to back up your data files, which is the most common thing that most people do. And another is to create an image, so it's almost an exact copy of your hard drive. Now, there are pros and cons to both of these. If you back up just your data files, when your C drive crashes, the steps are you go buy a new hard drive, you install Windows from scratch. That's predicated on you having your disks or making backup disks when the machine was new. You have to update all of the patches and all the service packs and everything that's come out since that version was installed, right? You then have to install any special software for the hardware, that what they call drivers, for your video card, for your network card, all these things. You then have to install all the programs you used to have, and that's, again, predicated on you having the original disks. Update those, so Office needs to be updated, those kinds of things. If you had a network, you have to reset your network settings. If you had a printer, you have to install the printer drivers. It's this big, long, convoluted process that can take people weeks, and usually what happens is people can't find half their disks. So the good news is you got your critical information backed up. The bad news is you don't have a good restore process. You don't have a disaster recovery plan. Because now you're going to go through all this, you're going to muddle through all this. So if you can get to that point, then you can restore your data. That sounds really exciting, huh? So to avoid that, you can do what's called an image backup. And we have a product that we started working with years ago that we developed. We call it a Data Vault. And there's a lot of other companies that have similar products. And the Data Vault basically looks at your computer and makes an image copy. So it looks at everything that's there as it is and makes a copy of it so that all of those settings, all of your favorites, all of your network settings, all of that stuff, your address book, all of that's automatically saved and in the right order so that you can restore that image and be right back to where you were. Or in the case of an external drive and the Data Vault, you could literally take the hard drive out of the enclosure, take the failed hard drive out of your machine, replace it with the one that was in the Data Vault or that was in your external drive, start the machine up, and it's like whatever your last backup was, you're right back to that point with all of the settings and all that stuff that you want. So the downside to doing a pure image backup is you only have one backup. And so if you delete a file or if you get file corruption and you don't catch it in time and then you do a backup, you see the problem there, right?
Yeah.
So one of the other options is you can create multiple images, which requires a little more sophistication on the part of the user and the software, or you can layer in another kind of backup system like you can do an image backup with the external hard drive and then use one of the online backups just for your data. So you got double coverage.
It'd be nice to have an image backup that would update with the changes in your new documents.
Well, you can do that. The problem is you don't have any redundancy. See, a good backup strategy has multiple copies. Because, see, if you don't catch corruption, you don't catch a virus infection, you don't catch something in time, and then you run the backup procedure, right, to catch what's changed,
sure.
You're overwriting or creating because you don't have any redundancy. I'm sorry?
To me, the most important thing is to have a copy of all your program files and the operating system, because most documents, I save to my thumb drive or I email it to my office and save it there at the office.
Okay, and what you're trying to do is put yourself in the best position should you have a catastrophic fail and you don't want to go through 2 weeks worth of recreating your machine, mm-hmm. then the image backup system makes perfect sense for you. As long as you understand that the downside, if you're not careful, is that you don't have any real protection from a redundancy standpoint for your data files.
Yep.
So if you're layering in that you're copying, you're making an extra copy of your data files, your critical stuff to a thumb drive, to an offsite backup, to an online backup, whatever.
So do you buy the software for that image?
Yeah, the software is the key.
That's the Data Vault?
Well, no, you already have the external hard drive. We use Acronis, the Acronis software for imaging. So Acronis makes the imaging software we use. We're also testing some new product. We're about to come out with a whole bunch of new, we're testing this, all the different backup systems that are on the market right now, both for the show and for what we believe is in the best interest of our customers. So if you're not in a huge hurry, you want to wait, you can wait for our evaluation of that. If you'd like to get something going right now, we use the Acronis software, and you can buy that online. You can buy it in most computer stores or bookstores or, you know.
And how's that spelled?
Acronis, Acronis.
Okay.
You just look it up in Google.
Okay.
But again, you're going to have to understand how to configure that so that you're getting an image, because that's you have to know how to tell the software what you want it to do. It's not like the software only does one thing.
It's not very user-friendly?
Well, it is for me. I can't speak to your level of understanding of, you know, new software. It's not like you plug it in and go. Now, a couple of the products that we're testing right now, literally, you plug them in, and it automatically does everything, including install and configure the software and what have you.
Okay.
But, you know, we're still testing them because it's one thing to listen to a PR pitch. It's another to have it work one time. We're thoroughly testing them to make sure that that all of the bases are covered.
So when will you be announcing results?
It's going to be a little while. It'll be a couple weeks still.
Okay.
Because we're going through a pretty thorough evaluation. Here's the deal. You have to think in terms of, is your backup strategy covering you from theft, right? If somebody comes in and all you have is an external backup and they steal your computer and your backup, you got nothing.
Right.
Fire, house burns down, your backup was in the house with your computer. Data corruption, if you don't have redundancy and you don't catch it in time, all your backups are corrupted. Equipment failure, which is a very common thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
What happens when something catastrophic happens? Do I know what to do? What's my disaster plan? Most people have a backup system that they've never thought about, what am I going to do? You know, if the hard drive fails, what exactly am I supposed to do? And then they're scrambling, trying to figure out, you're trying to create a disaster plan during the disaster. So I was like, thank you, Mr. George Bush and Katrina. You know, don't put yourself in that position. Think it through now. Is what I'm doing right now going to cover me for these common occurrences? In businesses, you got to worry about sabotage, you know, all of those other issues. So you need to think through, do I have all of this? Having the online backup as part of your backup strategy, it doesn't have to be the primary, but having that layered in. See, the problem with using a flash drive as any kind of a backup, there's two problems. One, they're limited in size, but let's just say you can put all the stuff that you want on there. You know how often I hear people saying, I've lost my flash drive?
Really?
And so now they lost their backup, and it's personal information that anybody, all they have to do is plug it in, and they have it. Whereas the online backup systems are encrypted backups that you're the only one that can get into it. If you lose your password, all bets are off. They can't break in and get your stuff. It's very, very secure, and it's off-site. So if something happens at your house, something happens at the business, that data is secured off-site there. So, you know, the best thing these days is to have that two-step approach. Get that external hard drive, get the imaging, and then the critical stuff. Typically speaking, I like these online backup systems.
Do the online backup systems do a mirror image?
They can, but again, the problem with that is restoring that. Hang on here. We're coming up on a hard break here, but I'm going to talk to you some more about that. It is the Computer Corner. We're talking about the death of email. Back after this. Hey, we're only a couple hours away from, well, many, I guess more than a couple of hours away, but the fireworks season, I mean, the ultimate fireworks shows in the cities that are still doing it. The reason I'm bringing it up is it's a photo op, is it not? Taking pictures of fireworks. I mean, that's as American as apple pie, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, most people have no clue how to do it. This is where the Data Doctor's newsletter comes in to the rescue. Before you try to take those pictures tonight, spend a few minutes and learn from the link that we have in our newsletter about taking better fireworks photos. Digital cameras have a lot of extra features, 90% of which most people have never even looked at. They don't know how to use them. And just by learning one or two things about how your camera works, you can take a phenomenal fireworks picture. If you just go all automatic and just let the camera make all its own decisions, you might get a decent shot and you might not. Why leave it to chance? Read the newsletter and be more smarter.
So are you going to read the newsletter so you can take the pictures tonight?
If I'm still awake when the fireworks are popping tonight, you think? I'm not going anywhere near those crowds. You?
No.
You?
No.
Okay.
I'm swimming.
I need a really big telephoto to get it. We're too far away from the action.
Yeah.
For the rest of you.
Actually, you know what? Might be a good idea. Walk up to that mountain.
You go right ahead. You go right ahead. Climb every mountain.
Just me.
Start singing the song, baby. By the way, we've said this a million times, but since we're talking about email, those of you that think click removing me or that think that clicking the remove me or unsubscribe link on spam is a good idea.
It's a bad idea.
Fail, wrong, bad. It's a ploy in most cases. Why would somebody follow the rules that didn't follow the rules to begin with? Somebody sent you an email without asking your permission. What makes you think when you ask nicely to be taken off the list that they're going to take you off? Now, the exception is name brand products, name brand websites that you know are legitimate websites. So if you are getting something from Amazon and Amazon has an unsubscribe, okay.
Well, it's someplace that you requested.
Well, you may or may not, or you may not remember, right? Southwest Airlines. I don't remember ever saying, send me this stuff. You probably did. So you might think it's spam. You might call it spam. In fact, you can safely unsubscribe from Southwest Airlines because you can trust the brand. It's all these other things that are out there that you don't know anything about. Unfortunately, I can't tell you when it's going to be real and when it's not, but 9 times out of 10, it's probably not real. They're just trying to get you to validate your email address. And as soon as you click on the remove me or unsubscribe or respond back with remove me, anything like that, you validated your email address so that they can say, okay, let's put that into the list of valid email addresses so we can sell this as a valid email list to other spammers. Thank you so much, Spam America. Why do you think 96-97% of all messages, 99 out of 100 of those cars on that 100-car train that, you know, that's pulling in front of you, 99 of those cars have junk in them? That's what's going on in email today. That's why it's broken. You can't trust. You have no way to really verify take my advice. Take a look at these resources. We've talked about it throughout the show, but take a look at the resources we have at datadoctors.com/radio for today's show. You will find ways to start using other communication tools that are out there to eliminate the grief and the pain and the uncertainty and all the stuff that's going on in email today. I mean, it's 96, 97% of everything that's going through the email system is junk. That alone should tell you, maybe this shouldn't be my primary way to communicate with people. Now, there is a reason why Twitter and Facebook and all of these things are really, I mean, the photo sharing sites, Flickr, all, it's because it's a much easier way to exchange information with people you trust. You have better systems for blocking, allowing people into your world, not allowing emails so wide open and so messed up. Those of you that think pictures are really cool in your emails, think again. That's a signature, any kind of image, any kind of graphic, a picture of yourself. One, it increases the size of the message, not by much, but you're automatically increasing your spam score. So you've got a much higher chance, if you have an image in your email, of being scraped out as spam or potential spam. When all you want to do is communicate these two sentences. You don't need all the junk. You don't need large fonts. You don't need all of that stuff to get this information across. So simplify your email transmissions to improve the chances of those transmissions making it to the people you want. And then start finding alternatives. I assure you, a year from now, when you migrate to these other things, you're going to see the light. You're going to thank us. You're going to love it. You're going to be where we are as well. So, Anita, thanks for coming in.
Thank
Wasn't
you
so bad, right?
No, it wasn't okay. too bad.
Taylor, as usual.
Yep.
We'll work on maybe some more fun stuff for down the road.
Yeah.
And all of you out there, please be safe. Happy birthday, America, or happy celebration.
Happy 4th of
Independence,
July.
Yes. We'll see you all next week.